But society is made up of individuals, and in the case of the idea that Mars was inhabited, these individuals often embellished their supposed objective scientific findings. Supported vigorously by the press, the most important proponents of the life on Mars scenario were the astronomers. But the position was also championed by the inventors. Elihu Thompson, a long-time stargazer and friend of Professor Pickering's, was so enthusiastic that he often took his telescope to his factories so that workers could see the Martian canal system with their own eyes. Other eminent scientists included Lord Kelvin, who upon his arrival in America in September 1897 announced to the press his idea to flash a signal at night from the glittering metropolis of New York City to Mars to let them know we are here. No doubt he discussed this plan with Tesla when he visited his laboratory during the journey. Edison, too, was caught up in esoteric causes, but his wish was to invent a telephone-like device to contact departed spirits rather than living Martians. The possibility of beckoning Martians was the extreme application of my principle of propagation of electric waves, Mr. Tesla told the interviewers in 1896 in the article, Is Tesla to Signal the Stars? The same principle may be employed with good effects for the transmission of news to all parts of the Earth. Every city on the globe could be on an immense circuit. Thus, a message sent from New York would be in England, Africa, and Australia in an instant. What a grand thing it would be! 18. High Society, 1894-97. Nikola Tesla is one of the great geniuses and most remarkable men who have ever had anything to do with electricity. It is as much of an honor to propose him for membership as his membership would be an addition to the club. Letter to the Players Club by Stanford White. Commuting to New Jersey was only a temporary solution, and within a few weeks Tesla returned to New York, where he secured a laboratory just below Greenwich Village near Chinatown at 46 and 48 Houston Street. Nervous and perpetually on the brink of exhaustion, Tesla began to experiment with the healing properties of his oscillators as reports began to filter in from around the country about its remarkable curative properties. These high-frequency vitality boosters would generate a universal healing agent that, when applied, would enable the body to throw off all diseases, said Dr. F. Finch Strong. Effects obtained included increase of strength, appetite, and weight, induction of natural sleep, and elimination. Other doctors reported the ability to cure tuberculosis. Tesla believes that electricity is the greatest of all doctors, and says that when his laboratory was burned, nothing but regular daily applications of electricity kept him from sinking into a state of melancholia. My high frequencies, he would say, produce an anti-germicidal action. Thus, as part of his routine for a day at the lab, the inventor would disrobe, step upon his apparatus, and turn on the juice. A prickly corona would envelop his body and restore it to a more pristine condition. Electricity had become the new panacea. It could cure the sick, eradicate the criminals, and even eliminate recalcitrant undergrowth that interfered with the running of trains. Weeding has always been considered very hard work, but with the aid of the electrical weeder, a man has only to touch a button and the weeds vanish. In May 1895, Tesla and the Johnsons attended the dedication ceremony for the new arch, situated as the gateway, looking south to Greenwich Village at Washington Square Park and looking north to the beginning of Fifth Avenue. Designed by Stanford White, the dashing man with the red moustache, the lofty edifice stood taller and wider than any comparable one erected by the mighty ancient Romans or Greeks. Johnson had recited one of his poems in honor of the original wooden one, which had been built in 1889. This was but one more connection between Tesla and the celebrated Stanford White, whose many other monuments and buildings were rapidly reshaping the city into a regal testament to the great and vibrant gay era. Tesla would often run into White at the offices of the Century, where the artist would be commissioned to illustrate their covers, and at meetings involving the Niagara Falls Enterprise at Delmonico's, the Waldorf, and the theater, or the Madison Square Garden Roof Restaurant. Having designed the Players Club in Manhattan in 1887, the tennis club in Newport, churches and numerous mansions, White was also an interior decorator. It was said that he knew the colour of the boudoir of every woman of note in the city. A trendsetter and sensualist, White became one of the leading choreographers of the ambience of the percolating metropolis. Good friends with the inventor, White often talked with Tesla about their shared vision of the future. Tesla had met White in 1891, when the piano virtuoso Ignacy Paderewski played the garden for 5 breathtaking performances. Edward Dean Adams was in the midst of courting both men, Tesla for his inventions and White for his architectural prowess, and he wanted to get the two together to discuss the best way to place Westinghouse's behemoth electric generators in the upcoming powerhouse. "My dear Mr. Adams," White wrote, "I duly received the information of the Cataract Construction Company and will pitch in as soon as possible. With McKim in Chicago and Meade in Canada, I am here alone in a sort of maelstrom of work. If it were not for the roof garden and the ballet girls to cheer me up, I should have been dead long ago." By the end of the year, White had sent Adams designs for the proposed buildings. Adams reciprocated by sending White a magnificent text on precious stones and a stunning gift, most likely a ruby or emerald. In 1893, Tesla and White crossed paths again, as both were cardinal participants in the Chicago World's Fair. The following year, White, then 40, urged the inventor to become a member of the Players Club. "Will you not let me put you up for membership?" he inquired. "It is an inexpensive club, and the character of man I think you would like, and I know it would give me the greatest pleasure to meet you there now and then." Tesla requested that Johnson be included for membership, and White agreed. In the heart of winter in early 1895, White invited Tesla for a little supper for the artist Ned Abbey in my room in the tower, and Tesla sharpened his appetite for the occasion. There in White's sanctuary, where one's mind could spin 1,000 tales, the duo gazed out over the entire city. This moment symbolized the pinnacle of social achievement, for only the elite could enter White's chamber, and only the imagination of the outsiders could discern what might transpire. A month later, the inventor reciprocated by asking White, his wife Bessie, and their son Lawrence to his den. March the 2nd, 1895. "My dear Tesla, I cannot thank you too much for your kindness in showing all your wonderful experiments the other day. They made a deep impression on me, as they did everyone, and I'm going to see them again some day, if you will let me. Sincerely yours, Stanford White." A fortnight later, the laboratory was in cinders, but for the electronic savant, it was almost as if he were simply shifting gears. In the spring, he received a risque invitation to White's outrageous Girl in the Pie banquet. As the story goes, and there are a number of versions, a dozen scantily clad maidens served a 20-course meal at the notorious photography studio of Jimmy Breeze at 5 West 16th Street, the dinners having been shipped from Sherry's. Attending the clandestine affair were other friends of White's, including artists August Saint-Gaudens and Robert Reed, and the inventor Peter Cooper Hewitt. At the culmination of the feast, with the band playing, the young ladies returned in even more provocative outfits, singing and wheeling out a pie the size of a small automobile. To the tune of 4-and-20 blackbirds, the crust burst open with a flutter of a flock of canaries, and out popped a topless young woman. Mum was the word until sketchy details were published in the World. Tesla became privy to the architect's salacious activities and may have partaken himself in discreet entanglements, although it is just as likely that his phobia for germs or monastic inclinations would have inhibited him. White admired Tesla as each in his own way was a sculptor of the new age. Meeting occasionally for a round of pool at the Players Club or at a boxing match, perhaps with Twain at the Garden, Tesla also accompanied White for sailing jaunts out at Southampton with a dozen members of the clique. On one occasion, White asked Tesla to join him for an outing with Mr. William Astor Chamber, an African explorer. As usual, Tesla was busy at work, but after some tactful prodding, he relented. "I am so delighted that you have decided to tear yourself away from your laboratory," White said. "I would sooner have you on board than the Emperor of Germany or the Queen of England." The year 1895 was a peculiar one. The U.S. government was nearing bankruptcy. In the panic of 1893, bondholders had wished to secure gold instead of paper money, and the mint had made good by depleting its reserves. By January 1895, the United States was within days of being unable to meet its debts. Quietly, President Cleveland had asked August Belmont, a wealthy Jewish businessman and backer of the Westinghouse Company, to meet with the European Rothschilds to secure replacement gold reserves. The reality of the day, however, included an unfortunate worldwide wave of anti-Semitism. Only the year before, in a famous trial in France, the Jewish captain, Alfred Dreyfus, had been convicted on a trumped-up charge of treason. The Rothschilds were Jewish. How would it look to have Jewish financiers bail out an entire nation? It was for this reason, according to Morgan biographer George Wheeler, that J. Pierpont Morgan, an upstanding Episcopalian, was brought into the picture. Morgan, with Belmont's help, was able to secure $60 million in foreign gold reserves, and the country was saved from insolvency. The incident also marked the anointment of Morgan as King of Wall Street. In October, a 22-year-old, well-mannered stenographer named George Scherf walked into Tesla's laboratory and applied for a job. The inventor reviewed the secretary's credentials and hired him. Although Scherf knew nothing about electrical engineering, Tesla was impressed with his demeanor and intelligence, and within a matter of days, the youth was busy at work transcribing papers and taking over the general management of the office. In the same month, Tesla forwarded a book on Buddhism to Luca, whom he hadn't seen since the end of the summer. Johnson had traveled with his wife to Italy to receive a decoration from King Humbert for his work on securing a law for international copyright, and during this period, Tesla had taken some time to attend lectures in Brooklyn on Buddhism by Swami Vivekananda. "My dear friend and faithful stranger," Johnson wrote back, "I am touched by your remembrance of me in sending the book. I'll drop into your laboratory some day for old acquaintance's sake. Glad to know that you are again in town and established in the beautiful Johnson mansion," Tesla wrote Mrs. Philipoff. "I cannot say as much for my laboratory, which is still in need of furnishing." Tesla reported the local gossip, such as how Stanford had difficulty in deciding between which of two beautiful sisters to spend an evening with. The gist of Swami Vivekananda's lectures on the external nature of God and the transmigration of souls, and of his progress in netting more millionaires. He was meeting with railroad magnate and U.S. Senator Chauncey Depew, J. Beaver Webb, a fleet captain, shipbuilder, and Morgan man, Darius Ogden Mills, a stock market manipulator and principal in GE, and John Jacob Astor. The wealthiest of the crew, except for Astor, was undoubtedly Mills, who had made his fortune in San Francisco during the California gold rush. Owner of the New York Tribune and a palace on Fifth Avenue opposite St. Patrick's Cathedral, of which a Shah of Persia might have been proud, Mills had been the second private citizen in history, after J. Pierpont Morgan, to have his abode illuminated by electricity. As Herbert Satterley tells the story, Mills was so impressed with the Edison invention that he insisted on becoming a partner in the company. "Only if for every share of Edison stock you purchase for yourself, you purchase one for me," Morgan replied, and Mills agreed. Tesla had much to tell his European traveling friends. At the end of the year, Tesla began to apply more pressure on Edward Dean Adams to influence John Jacob Astor. The colonel, as he was now called, was funding, of all people, mountebank John Worrell Keeley. This was a situation that had to be changed. Keeley's motor hadn't motored in 20 years. Tesla's had turned the world. Martin wrote the inventor of his astonishment at Astor's gullibility. Tesla pressed Astor for a commitment. Attempting perhaps to capitalize on the Christmas spirit, Tesla met with Astor and his nautical counselor, J. Beaver Webb, on December the 19th and pitched his cause. "I am impressed with your endeavor, Mr. Tesla," Astor commented, "although, as I understand it, Your latest inventions are yet to reach the point of being marketed. Nevertheless, I'll speak to Mr. Adams. By all means, let's keep the door open." Tesla telephoned Adams that afternoon and wrote Astor the following day. "My dear Mr. Astor, Adams would be only too glad to have you with us. We agreed that we would jointly provide from 500 to 1,000 shares of the parent company for yourself and Mr. Webb at the price of $95 a share of a par value of $100 each. The parent company owns my patents and rights in foreign and domestic markets, which I believe will profoundly affect the present state of the mechanical and electrical arts, and will create a greater revolution in their applications than my ideas on the transmission of power, which are at present generally adopted." Christmas was drawing near, and with it the renewal of the Serb's link to his adopted American family. The invitation from the Johnsons was wholeheartedly welcomed. "My dear Luca," Tesla wrote, "I am, as you know, very fond of millionaires, but the inducements you offer are so great that I shall set them aside to partake in the splendid lunch which Madame Filipov will prepare. For Christmas, I want to be at home, 327 Lexington Avenue, with my friends, my dear friends, the Johnsons. If you will prepare a dinner for a half dozen and invite nobody, it will suit me. We shall talk of blessed peace and be merry until then." Tesla did his best to overlook the erotic tension emanating from Catherine as she directed the servants with Agnes to set the dinner table, and Tesla talked shop with Robert and his son Owen. Catherine could never be part of the bond that existed between Tesla and Robert. Her heart ached for what it could not have, and yet simultaneously was filled with what it now possessed. With Robert out of the room, Catherine was too intense. She claimed a telepathic link to the wizard. Her breast palpitated when he was near. Hormones gushed. On one occasion, she edged them to the line. He had no choice but to withdraw. On the last day of the year, Stamford dropped off a note. He wanted Tesla to hire a promising lad, the son of his friend Charlie Barney, a banker with ties to Whitney and Vanderbilt. "My dear Mr. White," Tesla wrote back, "I heartily agree that the young fellow, who has two awfully pretty sisters, ought to be helped by all means. Unfortunately," Tesla continued, "he still had the responsibility of carrying three superfluous workmen, who were not really working because of the delay caused by the fire." As the relationship with the Johnsons became more intimate, there may have been rivalries between them over which one had the greater access to him. Tesla wrote after the new year, "My dear Luca, I am glad to know you shall love me, but I am much disappointed to learn that the boil has bothered you so much. I doubt, however, that you are a hero, because heroes do not go to bed on account of a boil." Although Catherine had seen Tesla twice in December, it only served to ignite her passion even more. Torn between loving a professorial and delightful gentleman who could count among his friends Mark Twain, John Muir, Rudyard Kipling, and Teddy Roosevelt, even if he did suffer from boils, and an exotic internationally known virtuoso whose singular talents promised to transform an entire world, Catherine wanted to feel herself en rapport with the wizard so that she could discuss their psychic link. February 12, 1896. "Dear Mr. Tesla, I have had such a wonderful experience the past 3 years. So much of it is already gone that I sometimes fear it will all pass away with me, and you of all persons ought to know something of it, for you could not fail to have a scientific interest in it. I call it thought transference, for want of a better word. Perhaps it is not at all that. I have often wished and meant to speak to you of this, but when I am with you, I never say the things I had intended to say. I seem to be only capable of one thing. Do come tomorrow. Sincerely yours, Catherine Johnson." Stamford might have been able to leave his wife on Long Island while he courted young starlets at his bachelor pad at Gramercy Park or his private loft atop the Garden Tower, but dear Mr. Tesla was cut from different cloth. He would often dine with women and tantalize with his eyes, but that would have to be the extent of a relationship. Apparently, Tesla undertook a self-imposed vow of chastity, having been influenced in part by Swami Vivekananda, who preached chastity as the path to self-transformation and enlightenment. Tesla met the Swami on February 13, 1896, at a dinner with Sarah Bernhardt, after one of her performances in the play Iziel. As with the rest of the world, Tesla had first heard of the Swami during the summer of 1893, when the Hindu gained overnight prominence after speaking at the Congress of World Religions, which had been held at the Chicago World's Fair. As Tesla had been in Chicago within a month of the talk, it is conceivable that he met or saw the Swami speak at that time. Vivekananda told the great electrician about Vedantic Prana, life force, and Akasha, ether, which according to Tesla are the only theories modern science can entertain. Having studied Madame Blavatsky's theosophical teachings, Tesla was already versed in the idea of Akasha and the Akashic records, which are, in essence, the records of all historical events existing in some vibratory state in this ether. The Brahma, or universal mind, the Swami continued, produces Akasha and Prana. Tesla agreed with the essential premise of this Buddhist view, replying that the theory could be proved mathematically by demonstrating that force and matter are reducible to potential energy. And then the inventor invited Swami Vivekananda, some of his devotees, and Sarah Bernhardt to his laboratory for the following week to demonstrate through experiments this principle. After Tesla showed the Swami some of his creations, the Swami advised that pure creation in the sense that something was born from nothing was not possible. To Swami Vivekananda, creation was a process of combining existing elements into a new synthesis. This idea of the eternal nature of existence, with no beginning and no ending, was appealing to Tesla, and he later referred to this and related concepts in some of his writings. Today, this theory in cosmology refers to the steady-state theory of eternal creation, which would oppose the more generally accepted Big Bang theory, which hypothesizes a particular date for the beginning of time. The reason that the Big Bang theory is the more generally accepted one is because the universe is expanding. Working backward, it appears logical that all matter in the universe was together at one time in one location. Current estimates place the Big Bang at about 15 billion years ago. How Astor could be taken in by Keeley was a mystery to Tesla, for the financier declined at this time to partake in the venture. He had taken a month to consider the proposal.
January the 18th, 1896. Dear Mr. Tesla, your letter offering me some of your oscillator stock received. 95 seems rather a high price, for though the inventions covered by the stock will doubtless bring about great changes, they may not pay for some time as yet, and of course there are always a good many risks. Wishing the oscillator as much success as I could if financially interested, and hoping soon to be able to use one myself, I remain yours sincerely, John Jacob Astor.
Although a rejection, the letter was not a complete denial. It was going to take one or two more go-arounds to land this big fish. The oscillators for Tesla, of course, were never ends in and of themselves. Tesla's goal was to send energy into the Earth and use it as a conduit to transmit messages and power. Details of the plan, however, were such a tightly held secret that even his workers were not completely confided in. Somewhat surreptitiously, Tesla took a train to Colorado Springs in late February 1896 to look over a prospective site for a new laboratory, and also to conduct the kinds of wireless experiments he had wanted to undertake before his laboratory burned to the ground. Tesla instructed a colleague, perhaps a local engineering professor, to transmit a musical song on an autoharp through Pike's Peak to his receiving equipment, which included another autoharp attuned to the first, 4 miles away on the other side of the mountain. The experiment was a success. The song, Ben Bolt, played on one side of the mountain, was picked up by means of a resonant earth frequency on the other. Tesla, however, completely confounded the details of the instrumentation involved. By implying to the press that the energy utilized derived from the earth and not from one of his oscillators, Tesla also succeeded in generating hyperbolic headlines as well.
Based on this false premise, page one of the March 8, 1896 Sunday magazine section of The World announced not only Tesla's historic wireless achievement, but also the supposed experimental verification that the Earth was imbued with free energy of essentially unlimited amounts. By tapping this reservoir, the future was clear. Electricity would be as free as air. The end has come to telegraph, telephone companies, and other monopolies with a crash.
19. Shadowgraphs, 1896. The rising claims of the inventors revives an incident in connection with the discovery of the Roentgen ray. Oliver Lodge announced apparatus by which he saw through a man. A few days later, Mr. Edison proclaimed that he had apparatus with which he had seen through two men. Within a week, Mr. Tesla produced rays of such penetrating power that they went clear through three men. When this was shown to Mr. Edison, the great man, who hasn't a spark of jealousy in his nature, smiled and said, "Well, let's stop it at three. What do you say? I think three men will do as well and prove as much as a regiment." New York Mail and Express. A few days before the new year, the scientific world was shaken by the remarkable discovery by Wilhelm Röntgen of a queer unknown energy that he called X-rays, which emanated from his Leonard and Crookes tubes. Mikhail Pupin wrote, "No other discovery within my lifetime has ever aroused the interest of the world as did the discovery of the X-rays. Every physicist dropped his own problems and rushed headlong into the research." Astonishingly, Pupin added, "To the best of my knowledge, I was at that time the only physicist here who had had any laboratory experience with vacuum tube research. I obtained the first X-ray photograph in America on January 2, 1896, 2 weeks after the discovery was announced in Germany." As Pupin could so neatly do, he forswore any mention of his compatriot. To Pupin, Tesla was a non-person. Röntgen gained world recognition virtually overnight with his announcement that he had discovered a new energy emanating from cathode ray tubes that could illuminate light-sensitive chemicals at the far end of a room, penetrate solid objects, and photograph the internal organs and bones of living beings. As Pupin noted, scientists from all over the world dropped their current projects to join in this exciting new venture. Tesla himself wrote no fewer than 9 articles on the topic in a 2-year period. Although Tesla may have noticed these rays and their effects on photographic paper years earlier, he did not pursue the investigations, and left no doubt that the discoverer of what he liked to call shadow graphs was Wilhelm Röntgen. Tesla had taken the word shadow graph from Søren Kierkegaard, who described them in his essay, Either Or. To the existential philosopher, they were sketches that derive from the darker side of life, but are not directly visible. The shadow graph does not become perceptible until I see through the external. Not until I look through it do I discover that inner picture, too delicately drawn to be outwardly visible, woven as it is of the tenderest moods of the soul. In Europe, meager X-rays were being produced by static machines and Ruhmkorff induction coils. Tesla suggested instead the use of a high-frequency disruptive coil attached to a special bulb with 2 electrodes, a cathode inside the vacuum for generating the cathode streams, and an anode placed as far away as possible outside the bulb to limit the reduction of the potential. With this apparatus, effective pressures of about 4 million volts were achieved. At first, the bulb will get hot and glow with a purplish hue, then the electrode will disintegrate and the bulb will cool. The use of a fan helps. From this point on, the bulb is in very good condition for producing the Röntgen shadows. When the electrode is too hot, it is probably because the vacuum is not high enough. Generating such high voltages, this work not only was set up to measure the quality of the energy emanating from the bulb and to test its ability to pierce living and non-living objects or be reflected, it also laid the foundation for Tesla's later experiments with particle beam weapons. Here, in 1896, Tesla discussed the idea promulgated by the quantum physicists a few years later that the energy had both particle-like and wave-like properties. Having set up a target to shoot the streams at, Tesla wrote, "The effects on the sensitive plate are due to projected particles, or else to vibrations of extremely high frequencies.